Welcome back to the Universalis podcast and Happy Advent. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday, the 30th of November. This last month of November has been all about endings, about death, which is the end of each of us, and about the Last Judgment, which is the end of the universe. With Christ the King last week, we have even looked a little beyond the end. Now December is coming, and we are on to beginnings. The feast we are going to celebrate on the 25th is the beginning of salvation for us. That's why it's such a big celebration. Advent is a very special time because that beginning is on its way. It's going to begin, but it hasn't begun quite yet. Advent is purple liturgically. The books call it violet. But it's a very different purple from Lent. Lent is about penitence and penance, and it is purple because purple is the nearest colour to black without actually being black. Lent is hungry. Lent is cold. Advent is purple too, but it is a rich and royal purple. Advent is the darkness before the dawn. It's a warm darkness, and you can wrap yourself up in it like a cloak. And it is a purple which announces the golden splendour that is on the way. The most difficult thing about observing Advent is this. We are so busy thinking and planning and even worrying about what lies at the end of Advent that we forget to be in Advent itself, in the now. We find ourselves thinking automatically that we are 3.5 weeks before Christmas and forgetting that today is today. The Church does her best to help us out of this. Even the physical churches themselves do. For instance, up in the sanctuary from this Sunday onwards, there is a candle stand with 5 candles on it. 4 are purple, 1 is white. This week, if you look at that stand, you will see 4 candles have not been lit. They show time that has been laid out for us, time that has been structured for us, but time that is not here yet. That is what those unlit candles are telling us. What the furnishing of the church does, the liturgy does too. It takes us step by step towards that mysterious and glorious place we are going. We can't call it Christmas yet. We don't know what it is yet, but whatever it is, we are being led to it, held by the hand. Our hands are being held to lead us, but also being held to hold us back from rushing ahead to see what's coming. If we do manage to keep ourselves firmly in the first week of Advent and not rush forward, we will be like the Jews of 2,030 years ago, more or less, praying for something to come with only a slight idea of what that something was going to be. Even the order of cause and effect was uncertain. Was it going to come because they prayed for it, or was God specifically inspiring them to pray for it because he knew it was coming? You can read it both ways. I don't know about you, but I find the same thing in my life sometimes. Having somehow given up hope in praying for something, one day I pray for it anyway, and the next day God makes it happen. Which caused which? The Church has to express all this in her liturgy and bring us close to the Jews of 2,030 years ago. The way she chooses to do this is with an extra jump. She goes back still further to 2,730 years ago, under the prophet Isaiah. As far as civilization is concerned, we are mostly Romans. Our institutions and laws are the way they are because Latin laws and institutions taught us. If we speak English, our intellectual language is all Latin or Greek. Many of the rest of us speak Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, French, Catalan, Romanian. All of them are dialects of modern Latin. The earliest stories from history that you learn at school may well be about the origins and foundation of Rome. At the beginning of the school day, when I was 6, we used to work on huge pictures we were painting of stories from history. We lay flat to have enough room, so our headmistress used to call us the sunbathers. I was doing a picture of an early Roman legend of Romulus and Remus, the twin founders of Rome, who were abandoned as babies and suckled by a she-wolf. Romulus built a wall round Rome and told Remus not to jump over it, and Remus did, so Romulus killed him. I was painting the wall, and it was a brick one because that was the only kind of wall I knew. I painted it brick by brick, and the bricks were small, so I might still be painting it today if I hadn't got too grown up for that. The point of that story is that the Romans, counting backwards, put the time of their mythical foundation at what we call 753 BC. They still count the city's age from that date even now and celebrate its birthday every year. And in 753 BC, that impossibly distant, misty, mythical Roman date, the prophet Isaiah was 12 years old. There is nothing misty or mythical about the Jews of that time. It is all history. The Jews had already left Egypt, wandered in the wilderness, conquered Canaan. They had already had the judges, Deborah and Samuel, the kings, Saul, David and Solomon. They had already split into two kingdoms, Israel and Judah. They had had Elijah and Elisha and some of the other prophets. Now in Isaiah's time, in a time that the Romans had nothing to say about except legends of babies sucking milk from a wolf, for the Jews, actual history was going on. Real history, too real and too much of it. Judah, with its capital at Jerusalem, was a small state with an empire to the east of it, the Assyrians, and an empire to the south of it, the Egyptians. The question for the kings of Judah was, do I save myself from being eaten by the lion by throwing myself to the tiger, or do I save myself from being eaten by the tiger by throwing myself to the lion? Into this time Isaiah was born. In this time he prophesied, and in the liturgy of early Advent we get prophecy after prophecy of his. They all echo the sense of a future coming, which is why it is that we have them here at all, and also a sense that the question you are asking about the current situation is not necessarily the question you should be asking. Earthly powers are not what it is all about. God operates to God's rules, and they are not the rules you think. Now, usually in the course of the year, the liturgy takes some care to make sure that the readings at Mass don't cover exactly the same ground as, for instance, the office of readings. But just now, this can't be done. Isaiah is where it's at. There's no getting away from him. 2,700 years ago, Isaiah answered the clever diplomatic plans of the kings by saying, "Stop looking down at what is going on here. Look up, look above, look through and beyond at the bigger reality, in God's time, not ours." 2,030 or so years ago, Isaiah echoed down to the Jews who felt that they had to choose between submission and rebellion. He said again, "Look up, look above, look beyond." And today, at the beginning of Advent, the beginning of the second quarter of the 21st century, Isaiah is still echoing down to us. I think it is an excellent thing to listen to him precisely, day by day, step by step, prophecy by prophecy, poem by poem, oracle by oracle. There are two ways of doing it, both of them equally easy if you use Universalis. You could look at the readings at Mass, or you could look at the Office of Readings at the first readings there. I've decided to go with the Office of Readings because it has big, solid readings. They are longer and deeper than the ones you get at Mass. So, let me go through this first week of Advent day by day. The great thing about the Liturgy of the Hours is that there's nothing at all to stop you focusing on just the parts you want, or on the parts that will do you the most good. The Eucharist is a sacrament, but the Liturgy of the Hours is not a sacrament. So the Eucharist can't be chopped around to suit individual requirements, it is a single whole. But the Liturgy of the Hours is not a single ritual, it is a treasure chest. And from a treasure chest you can take what you need. Unless you are under a solemn vow to recite the whole of the Office of Readings each day, you can take from it whatever jewels suit you best. If those jewels happen to be diamonds and rubies, then diamonds and rubies are all that you take. I am taking the first readings to be my jewels, my rubies, but I have noticed that there is a small diamond set just above each of them, just before each day's first reading. It is a simple half-line verse and half-line response that have been made specially to fit the mood of the day. Someone has worked these out carefully, so I will look at those as well. Let's start with Sunday. The verse says, "Lift up your heads and see, your redemption is at hand." The reading comes from the very beginning of the book of Isaiah. The kingdom of Judah is in ruins. In ruins in two ways, because it is physically destroyed by warfare, but also undermined by people turning away from God and doing evil. But salvation is still possible. Isaiah generally doesn't prophesy doom without offering consolation as well. Salvation does not come from more ceremonies, more rituals, more sacrifices. The real answer is, cease to do evil, learn to do good. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. On Monday, the verse says, "Let us see, O Lord, your mercy, and give us your saving help." Isaiah laments again over the moral state of Jerusalem. Everyone is cheating, everyone is oppressing the weak. God is offering a consolation. The consolation is fire. This is going to hurt. Do you think silver enjoys being put in a furnace to purify it and burn all the base metal away? But at the end of it, you will be pure silver. You will be restored, your polity and your integrity. And once you are restored, the entire world will come to you to worship the Lord. The Lord will give order to international affairs and there will be universal peace. On Tuesday, the verse says something you may remember from carol services. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, "Prepare the way for the Lord, make straight the paths of our God." That is to say, to be healed, you need to make yourself ready to be healed. In that day's first reading, Isaiah's prophecy says, "Preparing the way of the Lord is like real road building. It is done by crushing rocks into dust. When the glory of the Lord comes, it will be so brilliant you will want to hide from it. But there will be survivors, and the Lord will return to Zion. You will be given once more a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, and they will lead you as they once led you out of Egypt and through the wilderness." Wednesday is more about sadness than about hope. Isaiah's poem is about the vineyard God had and loved, but the only grapes it yielded were sour grapes. God says he will knock down the wall he built to protect it. He will even tell the clouds not to water it any more. And in the verse before the reading, we, the people who have been such a disappointment, offer consolation to God. We say to God, "Lord our God, turn our hearts back to you. Let your face shine on us, and we shall be saved." You can read it like a plea for mercy, but now I listen to it, it sounds more like a reply to God's lament over his vineyard. We are actually consoling God and encouraging him. Put back the wall, let the rain fall again, and see how fruitful we will be. Thursday jumps forward in time from the troubled present to the hoped-for future. It looks forward to after the healing and consolation of God. And it holds out a revolutionary prospect. Judah is not just a small, weak country, but the centre of the earth. Isaiah tells how the Moabites, who are hereditary enemies of the Jews, flee from destruction and take shelter in Judah. And all this not because the Jews are going to become world conquerors. There is no conquest. The throne will be made secure in gentleness and ruled by a judge who loves justice and integrity. The verse before the reading today tells it simply, "Listen to the word of the Lord, you nations. Make it known to coasts and islands far away." On Friday, Isaiah turns to the enemy empires, Egypt and Assyria, but he doesn't talk about their conquest or defeat, but their conversion. There will be an end to all these wars, and Israel will be blessed in the centre of the world. And in the verse before the reading, we begin to sound like impatient children asking, "Is it nearly Christmas yet? We can't help it." We say, "Lord, let your love come upon me. Grant me the saving help of your promise." On Saturday, we stand back and are mere spectators of history. The watchman looks out in the night. He sees horsemen coming two by two, announcing the fall and ruin of Babylon. The verse reminds us that even with all this tumult, we are God's people. The Lord makes his word known to Jacob, to Israel his laws and decrees. I have held your hand step by step through the week. I don't think I'll do it again in this much detail, because on the one hand it's too long to listen to, and on the other hand it's too tightly compressed and too much had to be left out. After all, the prophecy for each day is actually 4 or 5 minutes long. But if I have done anything by this, I hope I have encouraged you to open Universalis each day and look at the Office of Readings each day and read that first reading each day, and be with the Jews who listened to Isaiah in their time of trouble, and also with the Jews who prayed for the Messiah to come without knowing what they were praying for. A deep purple time they were in, with dazzling light on the way. Advent is not Christmas, but inevitably you are thinking of Christmas presents. While you are worrying about Christmas presents for other people, get yourself an Advent present now. In the Universalis app, subscribe to the Spoken Liturgy of the Hours. We are so used to reading a screen fast in a hurry to turn the page that we often don't take in what it actually says. Listen instead, and you'll find it all meaning more. Besides, you can listen in many places where you can't read, when driving, in bed before you open your eyes, out on a walk. I used to be able to say that the subscription to the Spoken Liturgy of the Hours was about the price of one cup of coffee per month, but coffee has gone up and the subscriptions haven't. So, now, a single espresso in a local cafe once a month costs a penny more than listening every single day of the month to the Office of Readings, Lourdes, Terce, Sext, Known, Vespers, and Compline. On the iPhone, iPad, or Android, try a free sample. Press the play button at the bottom of the page and see if you like what you hear. Of course, Universalis itself can be a gift for other people, and it's a good one. Have a look at the episode notes for this podcast and you'll see how to give it. The simple story is that you buy a code and give it and it lasts forever. It truly is a gift for life. People do drift away from God sometimes, but he usually gets them back one way or another. Apps don't go away once they are bought, so at the moment when your friend feels the need for it again, Universalis will be there waiting. It being Advent doesn't mean that there aren't saints to celebrate. If you're a Scot, you will celebrate St. Andrew on Monday the 1st, a day after his usual day, because Advent Sunday took precedence. In other parts of the world, Andrew wasn't important enough to be moved, and you'll have to wait till next year for him. On Wednesday the 3rd, we celebrate St. Francis Xavier. His life echoes what Isaiah has been saying about how we will become the blessed centre of the world. The salvation of the world is made known through us, which is a high honour. But the salvation of the world does not come through conquest. That, too, is clear from Isaiah. Naive missionaries telling backward natives to wear clothes is a lovely picture to make us feel superior to them, but that is not how it works. There are cultures out there that have been puzzling over the meaning of existence at least as long as we have. They are high, ancient cultures. They know they are right and they are set in their particular way of being right. St. Francis Xavier's mission to India and Japan was precisely one to societies which already knew how things were done. Take India, for example. I read somewhere that his efforts in India were a failure because he did not convert the Brahmins. I can't remember if the complaint was that he tried and failed or that he did not try. But on the same principle, one might say that Jesus failed because he ought to have ignored the fishermen and gone and preached to the Pharisees. There is a deeper point here. Adults are less flexible than children, and adult cultures are less flexible than infant ones. They don't absorb what they receive, but try to fit it in with what they already know. In India, to carry on with the example, there was the caste system. In our Christian sense, there were actually no Indian people. There were only a member of this caste, a member of that caste, and so on. Everything was dominated by what you were, not who you were. I have heard that one of the first Indian responses to Christian evangelization was to try to add castes of Christians in parallel to all the existing Indian castes. Was that a failure or a mistake, or was it a necessary first step? Was it on the way to making Christianity just another caste, in the same way that the Romans would have liked to make Christ just another god? Or was it a move towards the eventual dissolution of caste in the universal equality of Christians? The preaching of anything to anyone really has hazards of this kind. It is just more noticeable in the case of places like India and Japan. Perhaps for each of us, as missionaries and apostles in our own little way, the key is to do the best we can and not worry about it. God's will be done. On Saturday the 6th, it is the feast of St. Nicholas, Bishop of Myra in modern-day Turkey, who died about the middle of the 4th century. He was devoted to helping the poor. The story is told of how he secretly gave 3 purses of gold to a poor man who could not afford dowries for his 3 daughters, thus making it possible for them to get married and saving them from a terrible fate. In some countries, good children are given presents on St. Nicholas's Day. Even bad ones are. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.